Chapter 21. Any questions about Dorothy Kilgallen's mental state at age 52 have the same strange angle to them as do the circumstances surrounding her tragic death. One fact is undisputed. Kilgallen's marriage to Richard Colmar was rocky at best, a marriage in name only. Kilgallen kept appearances in public since it was important for her children's sake and for her career. Being in the public eye had its responsibilities, and she did her best to prove to naysayers that all was right and proper with the marriage. Regarding her mental state, there was some indication Kilgallen had become a heavy drinker, and that she and Johnny Ray appeared drunk in several NYC watering holes. A fellow columnist swore he saw them passed out on a New York street corner. No one confirmed his account. From time to time, there were suspicions, many emanating from unreliable sources, that Kilgallen had a drug problem. Sleeping pills were alleged to be the culprit, but how this information surfaced was a question mark, since certainly no one on the home front, not Richard, nor the children, nor Mark Sinclair or Charles Simpson, nor any of the household help, including butler James Clement, spoke of any heavy use of drugs. In her interviews with this author, Clement's daughter Brenda DeJordan never mentioned any concern her family had with Kilgallen's use of drugs. In 2017, Kilgallen's daughter Jill addressed her mother's possible use of drugs in an interview with New York Post journalist Susan Edelman. Jill, who stated, "I had a very close relationship with Mom," said only that both of my parents, because of their crazy schedules, occasionally took a sleeping pill or two. Fortunately, there is an eyewitness other than family members and close friends with an impartial viewpoint regarding Kilgallen's mental and physical condition shortly before she died. Joe Tonahill, co-counsel with Melvin Belli during the Jack Ruby trial, was asked in a videotaped interview whether he believed Kilgallen was a troubled woman on the downhill of her life, with drug or alcohol issues. He answered, "She wasn't struggling with any substance abuse problems or anything. I went to dinner with her at the 21 Club in New York City in July 1965. She didn't drink much, maybe one vodka tonic. That was about it." He added, "She didn't show any indication of being an alcoholic to me, or any drug use. She had a good mind, and her mind was working, very realistically and very effectively." Tonahill interview excerpts can be found at www.thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Weeks before her death, Kilgallen asked Tonahill to contribute content for her Random House book on the assassinations. Ruby's co-counsel also disclosed that just a week before her death, she spoke to him about appearing on a radio talk show together to discuss the assassinations and Jack Ruby. "She was as sharp as ever," Tonahill recalled. Rumors spread that Kilgallen's lofty position as the noted columnist for the Journal American may have been in jeopardy due to subscription problems causing the paper severe financial woes. Afternoon papers were experiencing difficulty competing for advertising revenue due to early evening television newscasts, including Walter Cronkite's. In fact, the newspaper did cease publication in April 1966, but this happened 6 months after Kilgallen died. Mark Sinclair believed even loss of her position as a columnist with the Journal American would not have changed Kilgallen's financial well-being. He said, "Dorothy's newspaper column was still being syndicated by the Hearst Syndicate across the country, and she was working on television and had book offers." What book offers Kilgallen may have had pending, besides Murder One, the Random House book, for which he had received an advance of $10,000, is unknown. He could have been alluding to her penning the separate JFK assassination book. At least that was the plan, according to Joe Tonahill, who initially believed Kilgallen intended the Ruby trial evidence to be part of Murder One. However, in a 1978 interview, he stated, "You asked why Dorothy never published an account of the episode, her private interview with Ruby. She was in the process of doing a book called Murder One. At least she and I talked many times over the phone about that book, and I was doing a piece for her, which had to do with irresponsible murder, as opposed to Murder One. She may have the material that I sent her in her notes. In a videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair stated, "I saw her open notes on the assassination and look at them. Murder One wasn't the book she had in mind for those notes." If one reads portions of Murder One, published in 1967 by Random House, it is immediately evident that none of the text deals with the JFK or Lee Harvey Oswald assassinations. However, following the Dorothy Kilgallen to the Reader section at the beginning of the book, it is mentioned that this section accompanied the draft manuscript from which the present book was edited, an indication Kilgallen had written a substantial portion of the Murder One book text. Reading numerous excerpts provides additional proof that Kilgallen's magic touch with the English language is woven into the stories included in the book. The superb writing style and word selection not only indicates Kilgallen was the author, but how savvy she was with the legal profession, despite no formal training. As mentioned earlier, F. Lee Bailey, attorney for Dr. Sam Shepard, and later for Patty Hearst, O.J. Simpson, and alleged Boston Strangler Albert DeSalvo, certainly admired Kilgallen's reporting prowess, stating as noted, "She was a very bright and very good reporter of criminal cases, the best there was." Jim Kilgallen was certainly proud of his daughter's accomplishments, writing, "Dorothy had an unerring instinct for news, a brilliant style of writing. She was accurate and had a flair for the apt phrase. She had an uncanny ability to produce scoops and an inordinate speed in turning out copy." To that end, Kilgallen told Variety, "Ever since I was a little bitty girl around the newspaper, I have been allowed to use my typewriter and my own head, and any opinions expressed have been entirely mine. When I have to get permission to write about something that interests me, then I will exit quietly from the field of journalism." Predictably, Murder One, published under Kilgallen's name, received excellent reviews, with at least four printings of the bestseller over the years. The cover certainly was striking. In bold red letters, the title appeared, and below it, "By Dorothy Kilgallen," in black print. Posted below, and to the left of Kilgallen's name, in a black circle with white lettering, were the words, "Six on-the-spot murder stories by America's most famous crime reporter." The back cover signaled the celebrity status Random House believed Kilgallen still enjoyed 2 years after she died. A black-and-white photograph of Kilgallen sitting on a desk, telephone pressed to her ear, was featured. On the inside cover flap copy, the following, in part, appeared: "The image of Dorothy Kilgallen as a brilliant, remarkably well-informed member of TV's What's My Line panel and caustic columnist whose voice of Broadway was devoured daily by millions tends to obscure her record of more than 30 years as one of the nation's top crime reporters. Her byline in the Hearst newspapers was a guarantee of sharp, accurate, and highly readable journalism. From 1934 to 1965, she covered many of the sensational murder trials that once shocked and fascinated the American public. No bleeding heart sob sister, she went after a story with vigor and tenacity that frequently bettered the best of her colleagues." Lost in the mix may be the realization that what Kilgallen wrote in the book is quite symbolic of the sharp mind Joe Tannehill and others recognized. If one reads Kilgallen's columns and articles published in 1965, there is the same ripe, polished, professional acumen to all of them, with no dip in the skilled level of the writing. To those questioning whether Kilgallen's mental state had deteriorated as the calendar turned to November 1965, what she wrote in all mediums serves as a dagger through such outlandish conclusions. Murder One is packed with Kilgallen's surefire talent as a wordsmith, the visualizations supreme. describing the scene after she had garnered an exclusive interview with Dr. Bernard Finch in the chapter entitled A Slight Case of Frigidity. She wrote, "The doctor was completely relaxed, sometimes even boyishly enthusiastic, as we talked. If he had not been in the defendant's chair in a murder courtroom, while photographers and lawyers and gun-toting deputies milled around, he could have passed for any well-tailored suburban father about to spring the latest photographs of the pride and joy." This skill as a wordsmith is also evidenced in her coverage of the high-profile Dr. Sam Shepard murder trial, a shining moment in the famous journalist's career. Kilgallen wrote, "There were a number of reasons for my startled reaction to the jury's verdict. Basically, the state had failed to present anything resembling a conclusive case that established beyond a reasonable doubt the doctor's guilt. Visualization permitting readers to feel as if they were in the courtroom watching the Shepard trial was a Kilgallen specialty." She wrote, "As Dr. Shepard walked with the deputy sheriff across the leaf-covered lawn, their wrists were so close, the handcuffs barely showed. He was hatless and ramrod straight in a light brown and tan small-checked topcoat, Burberry style, which he wore unbuttoned. Except for the stern set of his jaw and his pallor, he looked almost collegiate. He might have been, standing in the icy wind, not seeming to notice it, the local high school's football coach." As the Shepard trial wound down, Kilgallen was quite stunned when defense attorney Arthur E. Petersilge's final argument mirrored the words she had written in a Journal American story a few days earlier. Petersilge stated, "5 months after the murder of Marilyn Shepard, the state does not know how she was killed, with what weapon she was killed, or why she was killed. Yet on the basis of this flimsy evidence, the state is asking you to send Sam Shepard to the electric chair." The prosecution disagreed, calling Dr. Shepard an adulterer, perjurer, and cold-blooded murderer who deserved no mercy for the murder of his pregnant wife. The jury agreed, causing Kilgallen to blister the verdict by writing, "I could not have convicted him of anything, except possibly negligence in locking his back door. So I was aghast at the verdict." Dr. Shepard languished in prison and would in all likelihood have remained there for the rest of his life if not for the action Kilgallen took when she met Shepard's appellate counsel, F. Lee Bailey, in New York City. In the corner booth of a plush Manhattan hotel bar, Kilgallen and Bailey, a short bulldog of a man with the smooth mannerisms of a country gentleman, conferred over drinks. In a whispered tone, she told the famous lawyer about an exclusive interview she had had with the trial judge, Edward Blithen, a pipe-smoking son of a farmer who later became Cleveland's 46th mayor prior to the trial. True to her upholding a strong sense of integrity, Kilgallen had not divulged any portion of what she considered a private conversation with Judge Blithen. But when he died, Kilgallen felt it was her duty to do so. In the affidavit she provided Bailey, Kilgallen said the judge summoned her to his chambers due to her celebrity status. He then told her, "I am very glad to see you, Miss Kilgallen. I watch you on television very frequently and enjoy the What's My Line program. But what brings you to Cleveland?" She said she replied, "Well, the case has all the ingredients of what in the newspaper business we call a good murder. It has a very attractive victim who was pregnant, and the accused was an important member of the community, a respectable, very attractive man. Then, added to that, you have the fact that it was a mystery as to who did it." Judge Blithen, Kilgallen told Bailey, replied, "Mystery? It's an open and shut case." "Well, what do you mean, Judge Blithen?" Kilgallen asked. "Well, he's guilty as hell. There's no question about it," the judge proclaimed. Friends of his later disputed what he told Kilgallen, arguing the judge never used swear words like hell. Regardless, Kilgallen's disclosure impacted Bailey like a bullet train, and he quickly was able to confirm the judge's bias, since a court clerk had heard a similar remark. These disclosures became the hallmark of Bailey's appeal, and the United States Supreme Court reversed the trial verdict. Bailey gave great credit to Kilgallen's following statement as a deciding factor. To Kilgallen's relief, a subsequent jury acquitted Dr. Shepherd. Years later, DNA tests confirmed the verdict. The fugitive television series, starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball, was a huge success, leading to a film of the same name, starring Harrison Ford. The death of Marilyn Shepherd remains unsolved. Following Kilgallen's death, Richard Colmar very rarely, if ever, spoke about his wife, and never about her JFK assassination investigation, or any of the circumstances surrounding her death. Nevertheless, on September 29, 1967, Richard appeared on the Long John Nebel New York City radio program carried on WOR, the same station airing Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick. From the mid-1950s until his death in 1978, Nebel was a hugely popular all-night radio host with millions of regular listeners. What Richard had to say, never published until now, is quite important, since there are few people who ever spoke about Kilgallen's work acumen while providing an inside look at some of her personal attributes. Appearing with Richard were Nebel, Paris Flamand, the producer and perpetual panelist on the Nebel program, as well as the author of several books and one of the driving forces in the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, and Reverend Robert Schrock. Banter between the four men was lively, with Richard first speaking about Kilgallen's work on Murder One. Among the excerpts were, "There is a lot of Q&A in the book, as you know, and I never quite got around to making my point about the Q&A. The reason Dorothy wanted that in there is to prove that a very, very sagacious DA or defense attorney can win the life of a person by asking just the right questions. And it sometimes hangs on one word. And if you read this, and I have reread it some of the Q&A several times, and you can just see where the scales were tipped, and where the jury decided, this is a guilty person, or this is not a guilty person." Providing even more information as to Kilgallen's thoughts at the time, Richard said, "Dorothy felt that the Shepherd case was a miscarriage of justice. And yes, F. Lee Bailey himself told Dorothy that more than any other affidavit that they had, or any statement that had been made, hers influenced getting the guilty verdict reversed by the Supreme Court." When Nebel stated, "We were just talking about the passing of Dorothy Kilgallen. I said about a year ago. It's longer, isn't it?" Richard replied, "No, it'll be 2 years, November 8th. And you know there's an error in the front of Murder One." Nebel then asked, "Just to get back to the whole crime thing as represented and reflected in the book, did Dorothy prefer, or, that's a poor choice of words, find more fascinating the covering of a trial such as, for instance, the Finch-Trigoff trial, which is so incredibly complex and can be very difficult for a mystery story writer to parallel involutions. I should say convolutions. Or did she, was she, was there a depressing element that made her sometimes wish to eschew coverages of this sort?" After pausing, Richard replied, "She'd had so much experience with this matter of crime and murder that I think she approached these things absolutely objectively. I mean, she was human, for heaven's sake. She frowned upon sin and always regretted that a murder had taken place." To Paris Flamand, stating, "Oh, of course, but I was wondering, the play between the fascination and the obviously depressing qualities of a trial must rather tear a person." Richard replied, "She worked so darn hard, Paris. Every time she covered a trial, it just became a challenge to her. She couldn't, whenever she read about some mysterious death and there were important, a beautiful girl, and the cast was right, and a wealthy boy, and there were four suspects, and who did it, and it looked as though it was going to be a humdinger, she couldn't wait to get on a plane to go to Chicago or California or any place. and she rarely slept. She would go right from the courtroom back to her hotel room, get at the typewriter, and knock out hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words, particularly in these long trials, like that Finch-Tregoff trial was quite long, the Shepherd trial. Regarding other events Kilgallen covered, Richard said, "One, it was not a murder case, but it was an international scandal, the Profumo case in England. She flew to London for that, and covered the whole thing right up to the day when the poor guy killed himself, took his own life. She also covered two coronations over there, that of course had nothing to do with trials at all, and she covered the wedding of Princess Grace in Monaco, and she flew around the world." He added, "A very, really amusing experience would be to watch a television program with Dorothy, like Perry Mason or The Defenders. She was so familiar with court procedure and the techniques of lawyers and how they try to trip up witnesses and how, when they're supposed to jump to their feet and say, 'Objection,' that if the script was written wrong in her opinion, she would yell at the actor, 'You idiot, why would you object? It's irrelevant, it's immaterial.' Or the judge wouldn't have let him get away with that. Oh, she'd get very upset." How Kilgallen reacted to television shows like Perry Mason is quite revealing, with her criticizing those who presented what she believed was more fiction than fact about the courtroom dramas. As a woman of the truth, any deviation from that truth offended her.